Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The final push. Candidates make their closing arguments to voters before Election Day 2022 as control of Congress hangs in the balance. Then, making the call. While new lawsuits attempt to sow doubt about election results, we examine the detailed, reliable methods used to track each race and announce the winners. And the insurrection. The leader of the violent far-right Oath Keepers militia testifies in his trial for sedition relating to the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. It is Election Day Eve, and some 41 million Americans have already voted ahead of tomorrow. Lisa Desjardins begins our extensive coverage of the 2022 midterm elections.
Across the country, close, dramatic elections and big closing issues, including in key state Georgia.
Top of my mind, especially being in Georgia, is women's rights. And of course, the economy is a concern as well. But top concern for me, women's rights.
I already voted, and economy, security, national security, those types of things.
And as far as closing messages, Peachtree State Governor Brian Kemp stuck to that. Republicans' number one theme, the economy.
We've had a great team in Georgia for a long time. That's why our state's doing so well. Despite Joe Biden's 40-year high inflation, a disaster at the gas pump, a disaster at the border, in Washington, D.C.
Polls indicate Kemp has an edge over voting rights activist Stacey Abrams. Even more eyes, though, are on Georgia's U.S. Senate race, a must-win for Democrats. Incumbent Raphael Warnock is now in a dead heat with Republican challenger and former NFL star Herschel Walker. Their final plays? Words about high stakes.
I'm that warrior for God that is sick and tired of them trying to destroy this country.
I think competence matters. You should ask yourself if the person you're voting for has actually demonstrated any interest in the subject matter.
But nowhere are there more messages and more politicians than Pennsylvania, with its toss-up Senate race. Republican TV doctor Mehmet Oz's closing plan is to send messages to very different groups. He sat down with moderate U.S. Senator Susan Collins in Swing Buck County and separately appeared with President Trump in Latrobe. Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman brought in a president himself and one of Democrats' most popular figures, former President Barack Obama, as his Senate race closer.
Fundamental rights are on the ballot.
Current President Joe Biden finds himself with low approval ratings and his Democrats on the back foot in even some deep blue places like New York State, where he campaigned for Governor Kathy Hochul this weekend on a message about democracy.
Look. This election isn't a referendum, it's a choice. It's a choice between two fundamentally different visions of America.
Hochul faces a strong challenge from Republican Congressman Lee Zeldin in a state that hasn't elected a GOP governor in two decades. It's not just message, but also audience. Among former President Trump's other stops was this one yesterday in Miami, part of a key GOP demographic strategy this year.
The socialist, communist, and Marxist direction of the Radical Democrat Party is one of the biggest reasons that Hispanic Americans are joining our movement by the millions and millions and millions.
The weekend battle of the presidents also raged in Nevada, where former President Bill Clinton campaigned for vulnerable Senator Catherine Cortez Masto with a closing message of moderation.
She doesn't go around demonizing Republicans. She just gets up and does what she thinks right.
But some newcomers have dominated headlines by throwing fire, like Arizona gubernatorial candidate Carrie Lake, one of the GOP's most high-profile election deniers, who pounds away about the border.
They no longer want Arizona to be overrun with drugs and have the cartels controlling this border. This is our border, and we will build that wall. We will build the wall, and they're going to have to stop us from building the wall.
Aiming to stop Lake from winning is Arizona Secretary of State and Democratic candidate for governor Katie Hobbs, whose closing message is a plea for democracy.
It is a choice between sanity and chaos. It's going to be close. Every single poll has us tied, and that means we need every single person in this room to vote.
36 governor's races, as well as 35 Senate seats, and all 435 House seats are up for grabs on tomorrow's ballot.
And Lisa joins me now, along with White House correspondent Laura Barrón López, to share with us what they're watching for during these final hours. Hello to both of you. And Laura, I'm going to start with you. When you put it all together, what do you see as the party's closing messages, in particular from the president and others?
So for President Biden, as well as Democrats, it really comes down to three main things: the economy, democracy, and abortion. And we've seen in these closing weeks that the president, as well as former President Obama, have on the economy focused on not just what President Biden passed, trying to show that things like the Inflation Reduction Act, specifically prescription drug reform, could eventually help people and their pocketbooks, but also Social Security and Medicare. And so what they're looking at specifically there and what they've seized on is proposals by Republicans to cut spending for these safety net programs. And we heard Obama, as well as President Biden, talk about this a lot when they were traveling the country in the last few weeks. And then on democracy, President Biden really feels this very closely. It's part of why he ran for president when he saw threats in Charlottesville in 2017 with neo-Nazis rallying. And what the historians that talked to the president say that he really feels a need as the president to interject and say that he sees it as a big defining issue this election cycle, that there are a number of Republican candidates who say that they may very well not accept the election results if they lose.
And Laura, what about the issue of abortion? It was something that the Democrats had put a lot of stock in, making a difference for them. Where has it ended up?
So Democrats have clearly wanted abortion 5 months away from the Supreme Court decision to stay front of mind for voters. We've seen ads like one from Senator Catherine Cortez Masto in Nevada really trying to strike this contrast with her opponent Adam Laxalt on the issue of abortion. As well as Democratic candidate for governor in Pennsylvania, Josh Shapiro, focusing specifically, saying that it isn't freedom to say, to tell women what they can and can't do with their bodies. But two quick anecdotes for you, Judy. When I was in Michigan, every Democratic voter that I talked to named abortion or democracy as the issues that were defining who they were going to vote for at the ballot box. I also recently spoke to a Pennsylvania voter, an older woman, who says that she's voting for Democrats based on abortion because of the fact that she has a 16-year-old granddaughter. She voted for Trump in 2016, voted for Biden in 2020. Mm-hmm. And she also told me that she knows at least a dozen women who are going to vote for Democrats based on abortion and not tell their spouses or not tell their family. So I think that there could potentially be an element there of a silent abortion voter this year.
Really, really interesting. So Lisa, that's the Democrats. What about the Republicans, their closing messages?
Well, I think to Democrats, 3 points. Republicans certainly have 3 points as well. And I think our viewers won't be surprised what's at the top of their message. The message they've had this entire election: inflation and the economy. They are driving that home still. But to that, I think we're seeing them ramp up, especially on crime and the idea that crime, especially in cities where there are many Democratic voters, that they would like to stay home, and suburban women outside those cities who they are hoping to bring into the Republican fold. Those are messages we see a lot from Republicans right now. And one more, we're seeing some Republicans, to all of these negative ads, throw in something more human. For example, Senator Ron Johnson in Wisconsin has an ad now where he's raking leaves, very in contrast to sort of the tone we've seen for most of this campaign. So one of these ads that displays this is something I've been looking at, it from Lee Zeldin, the Republican gubernatorial candidate in New York, hoping to regain the governor's mansion there. Look at this ad. He's showing his children, first of all. That's him as a human. And then this ad pivots from his children to crime. Now, there was a shooting in front of his house in the last month, and he's trying to make that connection while using his family to make that point. One other thing Republicans are running on, Judy, the answer to the democracy question for Republicans, for Democrats, they're talking about nationalism. They're trying to say that the kind of fabric of the country is at stake.
And so, Lisa, we are seeing in a number of the polls moving in the Republicans' direction. You've been talking to them. What do they think their chances are?
Very good. And I think if you talk to Republicans and Democrats alike, they would all tell you, and they have told me, that momentum has been swinging Republicans' way in these last crucial few weeks. Now, when you talk about the House, first of all, Republicans need to pick up 5 seats in the House, as many of our viewers know. Some Republicans think they will do much better than that. And in fact, I've spoken to Democrats who believe they could even lose 40 or more seats in this election. Is that likely? they will say no. But is it possible? Yes. Now to the Senate, Republicans just need to pick up one seat. And it does seem like it is a toss-up, very close, many close races, don't know how they will go. But it's interesting that some of the seats Republicans thought were way out of reach, like New Hampshire, where Maggie Hassan is up against Don Bolduc, suddenly is more competitive. So the timing here of tomorrow's vote and the vote that have been accumulated the last couple of weeks really matters.
And Lisa, one other thing, at least one other thing you've been following, and that is the number of candidates who are election deniers, the 2020 election. What are you seeing there?
This is so important. This is something Laura and I have been talking about a lot and looking at. We have carefully looked at all of the Republican candidates for governor and secretary of state, looked at what they've said, analyzed what are their positions on the 2020 election, because it may tell us something important about future elections if they win. I want to show you the map of the Secretary of State Republican nominees. In dark purple, those are Republican nominees who have flatly denied the 2020 election results. You see many of them in states where they are likely to win, like South Dakota. However, some are in states that have competitive races like Arizona, where we'll be watching. And I want to point out, talk about two candidates in particular, Mark Finchem, who is the Secretary of State nominee in Arizona. He is a self-proclaimed member of the Oath Keepers. And in addition, Christina Caramo, who is the Secretary of State. That's Mark Finchem right there. He has said he will not concede if he loses. Christina Caramo in Michigan similarly has not said if she will concede. In fact, just today in the last few hours, Judy, she lost a lawsuit in Detroit where she was trying to get tens of thousands of ballots thrown out. That lawsuit has been lost, but it may be an impetus for her to say if she loses that she's not going to concede. All very meaningful and important to watch.
No question about it. And so glad you are continuing to do that. And finally, Laura, in connection with all that, these claims that the election may be, there may be rampant fraud in parts of this election. What effect is that having on the people who work around these elections?
It's having a significant effect. And I spoke to an election official today who told me that what's keeping them up at night is the post-election period. So these lies about election fraud, which of course there was no widespread fraud in 2020, a lot of these election officials expect this election to go off smoothly from an administrative level. But they're very worried that once the polls close and that period between polls closing and when the results are actually certified, that's what they're most concerned about. I also spoke to Catherine Kennelly, who's with the Institute for Strategic Dialogue. She tracks extremism, and she said that already they've seen an increase in the number of legitimate threats released across social media platforms like Gab, Facebook, threats that are being directed towards election officials, and that there has been an increase in that, and that these are very specific threats.
And I know these are all things we are going to be following very, very carefully tomorrow and tomorrow night. Laura Barrón-López, Lisa Desjardins, thank you both.
Thank you.
In the day's other news, a Russian businessman with ties to President Putin confirmed that his organization has interfered in past U.S. elections and will again. Until now, Yevgeny Prigozhin has denied election meddling. 4 years ago, he was charged in the U.S. with running a social media campaign to divide Americans before the 2016 election. The White House and the Kremlin would not confirm or deny today that they have talked about dialing back escalation in the war in Ukraine. The Wall Street Journal reported National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan has spoken with top Russian officials. Meanwhile, Ukraine announced that a new U.S. air defense system is now in place to help shoot down Russian missiles and drones. North Korea's military has punctuated its recent missile testing with new warning. The North declared today that the tests were practice attacks on South Korea and the U.S. U.S. and South Korean officials said that they are undeterred. In Egypt, world leaders heard stark warnings as they kicked off an annual UN climate summit. They will spend weeks discussing carbon emissions and demands that wealthy, polluting nations compensate developing countries hit by weather disasters. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned the leaders to act quickly.
We are on a highway to climate hell with our foot still on the accelerator. Excellencies, this UN climate conference is a reminder that the answer is in our hands. And the clock is ticking. We are in the fight of our lives, and we are losing.
Former Vice President Al Gore also spoke and told the leaders that, quote, it is not time for moral cowardice. Hurricane watches have gone up for the Bahamas and parts of Florida's Atlantic coast. That is after the storm named Nicole formed early today. It's expected to make landfall on Florida's east coast on Thursday, just weeks after Hurricane Ian blasted the southwestern part of the state. A federal judge in Washington, D.C. formally stayed Steve Bannon's contempt of Congress sentencing today. That puts his four-month prison sentence on hold for now as he appeals his recent conviction. The former Trump advisor was charged after he failed to turn over documents and testify before the House panel investigating the Capitol siege. In economic news, China reports that its exports dropped in October from a year earlier as falling demand and COVID controls took a toll. Imports also contracted, with COVID restrictions putting a damper on consumer spending inside China. And on Wall Street, stocks rose as investors bet that Republicans will block new tax and spending plans if they make election gains in Congress. Major indexes were up nearly 1% or more. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 423 points to close at 32,827. The NASDAQ rose 89 points. The S&P 500 added 36. Still to come on the NewsHour, Republican groups file legal challenges to the voting process before Election Day. Tamara Keith and Amy Walter examine expectations for the midterms. A high-profile political prisoner in Egypt goes on a strict hunger strike. Why casting a ballot remains a challenge for many indigenous people, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
Tomorrow night, as polls close and results come in, the NewsHour will rely on the Associated Press to call winners, as we have since this program began in 1975. This year, the AP has more than 4,000 reporters on the ground in all 50 states, monitoring vote totals to determine election outcomes. Races only get call when the AP is certain that trailing candidates have no path to victory. In 2020, they were 100% correct in calling state results for Congress and the presidency. To help explain more about when and how races are called and what to expect tomorrow, I am joined by the executive editor of the Associated Press, Julie Pace. Julie Pace, welcome to the NewsHour on this night, or before the big night. Thank you so much for joining us. 4,000 reporters around the country, an enormous operation. Tell us, just give us a sense of how it works. How do you get to the point where you feel confident to make these calls?
Thanks, Judy. And we're really excited and very well prepared to be able to do what we've done since 1848 at the Associated Press, which is to declare winners in presidential races and down the ballot beyond, as we'll do in these midterm elections here. So this is really, I would say, the single biggest act of journalism in this country. As you say, 4,000 journalists who will be across this country making sure that as votes are being counted, that we're able to assess the accuracy of the elections, look at our models, and declare winners. And our standard is certainty. You know, we want to make sure that when we call a race, that it's because there is no way that that trailing candidate can catch up. And we do that because we spend the whole year, you know, this is not just a one-night effort for us, we spend the whole year researching what the rules around voting are in each state, making sure that as those rules are changing, as procedures are changing, that our teams are across them. So we're very confident heading into this night, but we also want to be cautious. We know, again, that when we call a race, it matters. It means that that actually is the winner. We want the public to have confidence in that race call, and we feel like the work that we put in going into the night and the explaining that we will do coming out of those race calls about why we're calling the races, how we're making those decisions, we hope will also increase the public trust.
So who exactly makes the decision when a race is called?
So it depends on the level of the race. You know, we're calling races up and down the ballot. So I personally will be involved in some of the highest profile races. A team of senior editors in Washington will be involved in some of those high profile races. We also have an excellent and experienced decision desk that is going to be signing off on several of the Senate and House races. And then our team of analysts who really, again, spend weeks and months analyzing what's happening in the states that they oversee. Some of them have been doing this for years. This is definitely not their first rodeo. So it really ranges depending on the level of the race.
As you know, Julie Pace, there's a lot of interest and a lot of questions this year about when races will be called, how soon we will know results. We know in 2020 it took several days to get the results from Pennsylvania, for example. What should our viewers, should the American people expect this time?
Yeah, you're right, Judy. I think there are a lot of questions, certainly about when the races are going to be called and why it may take a while. And I would say that I think that just like 2020, I would urge your viewers to be patient. And that's not because anything will have gone wrong. I think that this is one of those things that is really important to keep in mind. Because of the changes to the ways that Americans are voting, more advanced vote, more mail-in voting, in some cases, it's simply taking longer for states, for counties to actually count those ballots. And so that may mean that it could take us longer at the AP to declare the winner of those races. If there's a large amount of mail-in vote that has not been counted yet and a race is very close, we want to wait for more of that vote to be counted. We think that's the only way to make sure that our race calls are fair and accurate, and that could mean waiting a couple of days.
So do I hear you saying that we may not know tomorrow night which party has won control of the House and the Senate?
It is certainly possible. You know, we want to wait for some votes to come in before we, certainly make any predictions on timing. But it is certainly possible that we could go to bed tomorrow night or wake up on Wednesday morning and not know the outcomes there.
And one last thing, and that has to do with what we know is this large, enormous, in fact, nationwide survey of voters, over 100,000 voters that the AP is going to be talking to. Can you give us just a quick sense of what that's going to look like?
Absolutely. This is something that I hope that a lot of your viewers will take advantage of, you know, in the hours coming into election night tomorrow and coming out of it, which is really VoteCast. It's our survey of the American electorate. And this allows us to not just tell you who won these races, but to tell you how they won, how Americans were voting, to be able to look at how different demographics of the American electorate were participating in this election. And, you know, given how divided this country is right now, given how many questions there are about, you know, which messages are appealing to which voters, we think that this is just as important as the actual results and should tell us a lot about where this country goes coming out of the midterms into the 2024 presidential election, which, as we all know, will start pretty quickly after the midterms.
And I know people will be hungry for information to understand how the election turned out as it did. Julie Pace, executive editor of the Associated Press, thank you very much.
Thank you, Judy.
As we approach the last day of voting in these midterms, scores of lawsuits have already been filed targeting the elections process in several key states. William Brangham has the latest.
That's right, Judy. More than 100 legal challenges have been filed in battleground states. They take issue with how votes are being cast and which ballots get counted. The lawsuits threaten to slow down the final vote counts and the certification of some results in key races. For more on what this all means for the midterms, I'm joined again by election law expert Rick Hassan. He's the director of the Safeguarding Democracy Project at UCLA's Law School. Rick Hassan, thanks so much for being back here. One of the sort of set of lawsuits that have been filed are around mail-in and absentee ballots and when those get counted and which ones get counted. Can you explain what's going on there? Who's filing those suits and what are they arguing?
So you're right that a lot of the lawsuits involve mail-in balloting, in part because we saw this huge uptick in mail-in balloting during the 2020 election because of the pandemic. And lots of states really had to ramp up, and there were questions about procedures that were going to be followed. Some of those questions have been answered. Some of them haven't. But one of the things that happened in 2020 was that Donald Trump cast aspersions on vote by mail, claimed that it was the way towards fraud. And so we've seen Republicans filing lawsuits trying to challenge certain kinds of absentee ballots or procedures. One big case is in Pennsylvania over what happens when someone sends in a timely ballot. It arrives on time, but there's no date on it. So we're seeing these kind of lawsuits. We're also seeing voting rights lawyers and Democrats suing over the uncertainty of certain rules as well. We just had a ruling this afternoon in Georgia where some voters in Cobb County, Georgia, had not received their absentee ballots, and a judge just issued an emergency order to make sure they have a way to be able to vote on Election Day.
A point of clarification here. Is the assertion being made by these largely Republican lawsuits against mail-in ballots, is there any evidence that these technical issues that they're arguing are somehow evidence of fraud? I mean, is there any connection there that they're trying to throw out ballots that anyone could look at and say, oh, these are fraudulent ballots?
Some of the claims are that the rules are too loose and they allow for fraudulent ballots to be cast. Some of the claims are really that the election administrators are not following the rules as they were set out by the legislature. That's a separate argument, but it's one that we heard Donald Trump make and others make, that the legislatures have certain powers over how federal elections are conducted. And when there's any deviation, that is not only potentially a violation of state law, but a violation of federal law. That's an issue that's currently pending before the Supreme Court in a case called Moore versus Harper. So we're seeing kind of these twin arguments. Some are about trying to prevent fraud, others claiming that election administrators are just going too far in how they're interpreting what the rules are in each state.
You mentioned briefly the Pennsylvania case. Could you tell us a little bit more about what's at stake there and how many ballots we could be talking about?
Well, apparently there are thousands of ballots that are coming in where people did not record a date. And we know the ballots are timely because these ballots have already arrived before Election Day. And so the question is whether or not they should be counted. There was earlier federal litigation claimed that under federal law, if you make an immaterial mistake on your ballot, it has to be counted as just a matter of civil rights. But there's also a claim under state law. What should the state law be? And just over the weekend, you had the Pennsylvania Supreme Court dividing 3-3 on the question because they just had a justice who passed away. They're evenly divided. And now some plaintiffs have gone to federal court trying to get a new ruling. And so there's a lot of uncertainty. Even in the middle of this, the state Supreme Court had to issue a second ruling explaining how its ruling was supposed to work. So if we have a very close election, say, for example, for the U.S. Senate seat in Pennsylvania, which everyone's watching very closely, it's possible that resolution of the election will depend upon how this legal question is answered about these timely but undated absentee ballots.
Separately, as you well know, there are certainly a large number of people running for office who have cast doubt about the 2020 election and said that there was fraud and stolen votes in that election. There have also been a small army of people deputized to go out there on this belief that there is widespread fraud, to watch polling stations, to monitor ballot boxes. That has caused some people to express real concern that there's going to be intimidation, perhaps violence or harassment at the polls. Is that a concern that you share that we might see tomorrow?
Well, we already saw some of this happening in some counties in Arizona where there were some self-appointed people to coming out and standing in front of drop boxes, some of them armed and with tactical gear. A federal judge had to issue an injunction to make sure that people had unfettered access to the polls. So we could see that tomorrow on Election Day. It's certainly something I'm worried about. I'm also worried about, as we saw in 2020, after Election Day, it takes a while to process all those absentee ballots, especially in those states like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin that don't allow for early pre-checking of these ballots to make sure they're accurate and are ready to be counted. And so we've seen protests and potential for violence at places where votes are being counted. So I'm concerned not only for voters, but for election officials and election workers.
All right, Rick Hasson of UCLA Law School, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Polls will begin to close tomorrow at 6 p.m. in the eastern U.S., but final results could take days to determine in some races. Here to discuss the indicators of what they'll be on the lookout for are Amy Walter of the Cook Political Report with Amy Walter and Tamara Keith of NPR. Hello to both of you. You can feel it. It's in the air. It's almost here.
Almost here.
What we've been talking about for a long time. So speaking of the Cook Political Report, Amy, with Walter, your House forecast for the House of Representatives suggests that Republicans are favored in 212 races. You need 218
right
to take control. Explain what you're seeing.
Well, what we're seeing right now, look, the challenge for Democrats all along has been the fact that they have the narrowest of majorities. They only currently have a five-seat majority. So it's not going to take much of a wave, a ripple among this electorate to give Republicans the majority. What Republicans are seeing, they say, they see a big wave that's about to crash to shore, mm-hmm. both in the Senate and in the House. What we're seeing is one that is maybe like, I don't know what we're going to call it, wave E, but maybe not a tsunami type wave, where Republicans pick up 15, maybe 30 seats, depending on just a number of key factors. One, who comes out, that's always important, but mm-hmm. critically, who comes out on Election Day? Democrats feel pretty good about their early voting in some of these key states, but we know, especially in these last couple of years, where Republicans' turnout is on Election Day, and they often surprise Democrats who assumed they'd built a big enough lead. And then the second thing we're looking at is where independent voters decide to go. We're going to be looking, you talked to Julie Pace about the AP on election night. I'm going to be looking very closely at where those independent voters decide to go on election day. When there's a big wave election, they tend to break by double digits for the party that's not in the White House. If it's a smaller margin, then we may see fewer seats. But right now, the expectation that we have is it's going to be anywhere from, let's say, a 10 to 15, maybe 20-seat majority for Republicans in the next Congress.
Yeah, and again, all they need is five, but
that's right.
The numbers you're seeing are,
that's right.
are clearly giving them
giving
the
them at least that number.
So, Tam, how much difference does it make for Republicans whether they have a little bit of an advantage or a much bigger one?
Well, when it comes to governance, the bigger the majority, the better in terms of actually being able to get their agenda through. One of the challenges that a potential likely speaker, Kevin McCarthy, would face is actually governing. And there are must-pass bills that will be challenging to pass because there are Republicans who have never voted for a budget, for instance. Mm. And they've had to have, in the past, when Republicans have been in power and a Democrat has been in the White House, they've had to rely on Democrats to help them get things across the line. How many Democrats will they be able to get? Will a Republican majority of this variety be willing to pass a budget bill, for instance? Or will they, want to extract huge concessions mm-hmm. from the president and his party? So it could be very challenging because there really, truly are a lot of Republicans who are in the always no caucus.
Well, there are the people in the vote no, pray yes category,
yes,
as one Republican, many called them, that they have to do it for optics reasons. But you know what, Judy, even a bigger majority for Republicans does have some problems for Kevin McCarthy, because many of those Republicans would be holding Democratic seats. Some of the, if we're talking about a wave, that means that Republicans are picking up seats in Connecticut and Rhode Island and California and Oregon, seats that Biden won by double digits in the last election. They'll have a really hard time holding those in 24 if those candidates are labeled as, right, and Republicans are labeled as the party that went too far to the extreme or the party that didn't vote for a budget or to default on the debt ceiling.
Or we're big fans of a former president,
right,
Donald Trump.
What we do know they'll be able to accomplish is investigations.
Yes.
And they have lots of plans to investigate yes. lots of things, potentially to embark on impeachments of various Biden administration officials. That part would be relatively easy. They can probably get good consensus on that.
So then there is the Senate.
Yes.
Remember that other body of the Congress.
Yes.
I'm looking at the Cook Political Report. Four states in toss-up. Talk just a little bit about why they're there.
When we say toss-up, we mean these are races that we really feel could go either way. These are coin toss type races where just the narrowest of margins separating Democrats from Republicans. What we do know historically, when we look back at ratings we've made over the years, they tend to break disproportionately in one direction. So you look at four seats, you say, okay, Democrats win two, Republicans win two, boom, here we go. We're basically back where we started. Usually, though, they break, three or four of them will break one way or the other. Again, traditionally. As we've been discussing, though, especially Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, those are states where we expect to not have an answer on election night. Georgia going to a runoff. Both sides seem to agree that that race is going to go into extra time. And Pennsylvania, Republicans feeling a lot better about their candidate there. Feels like mm-hmm. he's kind of gotten the late momentum in that election.
You've colored it red.
You've colored it red because it's a Republican-leaning yeah, state. Right. That's the state on election night, Judy. If they call it for Republicans, there's a very good chance that Republicans will have enough to win the majority. I would posit that. If Democrats hold it, doesn't mean they're holding the majority, but it does mean that they could keep a 50-50 Senate.
And Tam, the same kind of question that I ask you about the House, how much difference does it make for Republicans whether they stay at 50-50 or they do have that one or more seat advantage?
I mean, it would be helpful to them to truly have the majority.
Yes. Right.
And again, I think that in terms of governing, this is going to be, you know, if this goes the way that it looks like it's going, it is going to be 2 years of divided government where the president has a veto. Nobody has enough of a majority to override a veto. And there's just a lot of gridlock, which is not what anyone wants. And yet the American people on a very regular basis give America divided government.
And say that that's what they want. I mean, when you ask people in a number of these polls, they say they feel better.
Or that this idea that they want to check on the party in power. But the one thing that we do know also about 2023 is that we'll be talking a lot about 2024.
Yes.
And
yes,
the likelihood that Donald Trump will once again be a big part of the conversation. But Democrats are also talking a lot about what is Joe Biden going to do? Will he announce immediately he's running for re-election? What kind of signals is he going to be giving?
And we are hearing signals from the White House that he has every intention,
absolutely,
but they can't say it because there are legal things that happen,
absolutely,
once he does. But Tam, you're right. I mean, 2023 is going to be about 2024.
Oh, indeed. 2022, in a lot of ways, is already about 2024.
Yeah, I think
you know,
that's right.
just when we think we're done, we just go right into the next one.
Any last minute words of from the wise, I should say from the wise, not to the wise here, about what you're watching for tomorrow night? What might surprise us tomorrow night?
I'm watching New Hampshire. That's
yes,
a state that it should stay, given all that we've seen. Republicans, that would be a big upset. If they win in that Senate race, I think we're looking at a big night for Republicans.
Yes. I agree with Amy.
Okay.
I'm watching New Hampshire, too, and some House races in Virginia that should come in early and give us a good sense.
Well, we always watch the two of you, and I should say tomorrow night, Tam, you are going to be working hard with NPR covering this election. Amy, you're going to be here at this desk with us as we watch
yes,
the results come in. Thank you both. And a reminder to you, our viewers, that we will have the latest election news tomorrow right here on the NewsHour and all night on PBS with our special election coverage. The leader of the far-right militia group, the Oath Keepers, returned to the witness stand in federal court today. Stuart Rhodes is testifying in his own defense against seditious conspiracy charges that stem from his role in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. John Yang has more.
Judy, Rhodes testified today that he had no intention of either entering the Capitol on January 6th or disrupting the electoral vote count that day. On cross-examination, prosecutors pressed him on the Oath Keepers' reputation as an anti-government militia. Carrie Johnson is NPR's Justice Department correspondent. She's been in the courtroom nearly every day of this trial. Carrie, thanks for joining us. A defendant taking the stand in his own defense allows him to present his case to the jury in his own voice, but it also allows the prosecution to question him. How did each side of that equation work for Rhodes?
You know, Stuart Rhodes is a smart guy. He's a Yale Law School graduate who went on to be disbarred. And he had a good amount of time to tell his story. He told this jury in Washington, D.C. that he grew up basically dirt poor, part of a migrant farm worker family out in California. and that he considers himself to be a quarter Mexican American. He says that he supports law enforcement, that he's nonviolent, that as many as 30% of the members of this far-right Oath Keepers group are actually current or former law enforcement officials around the country. And Rhodes says he was not involved at all in any planning for the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. He didn't go inside the building that day. And when he found out some people affiliated with him did, he said it was a stupid idea that allowed his political enemies to persecute him. And that's how he wound up here, sitting in this witness chair in front of a jury, fighting for his legal life.
And what did the prosecution, did the prosecution make any dent in his story?
You know, the main witness against Stuart Rhodes in this trial so far has been his own words, his own text messages on this Signal, encrypted Signal app, videos and other statements he's made. And prosecutor Catherine Ricozzi tried to dismantle Stuart Rhodes on the witness stand using his own words. Of course, Rhodes says he was just engaged in bombast and big talk. But she showed a lot of evidence, including text messages just a few days before the assault on the Capitol, that said that they won't fear us until we come with rifles at hand. We need to push Trump to do his duty. And if he doesn't, we're going to do ours, Stuart Rhodes allegedly typed. Then she played for the jury right at the end of her cross-examination, a recording that someone made of Stuart Rhodes a few days after the assault on the Capitol, where Rhodes said basically his only regret was that he didn't bring rifles, and then he engaged in some violent rhetoric involving Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi. So the jury was paying really close attention, John, taking lots of notes. And I saw a couple of the jurors make faces at Stuart Rhodes as he went into kind of long-winded explanations on cross-examination. Of course, that doesn't mean they're going to convict him of seditious conspiracy or any other charge, but he may have turned off some members of this Washington, D.C. jury today.
This trial's been going on for 6 weeks, delayed by a lot of things. You've been in the courtroom, I think, all but one day. What's it been like?
You know, there have been moments of incredibly high drama and personal turmoil. Remember, this is about the assault on the U.S. Capitol. People died at the Capitol. Law enforcement officers took their own lives. Over 140 police and law enforcement were injured that day. And it could not be more serious. But the introduction of a lot of these documents has at times been slow. Still, it's quite interesting to watch the jurors take in all this evidence. We did hear, John, from several people who had been affiliated with the Oath Keepers, who basically got out before January 6, 2021, because they were so worried about the rhetoric and the way this rhetoric was trending. The idea that this jury has now heard from Stuart Rhodes himself, I think, is going to be a pivotal moment. And we're going to hear from other defense witnesses for the rest of this week, too.
How much longer is this trial going to go on?
I wish I could offer you a prediction. I hope we're going to be done by Thanksgiving. But with so many unexpected things, including one of the defendants getting COVID and delaying the trial, and one of the lawyers in the case having an accident on a scooter and breaking his arm, I'm leaving room for the unexpected here. One of the jurors says they're moving out of state a few days before Thanksgiving. Let's hope we're done by then, John.
Carrie Johnson of NPR, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Global leaders are meeting at a pivotal conference in Egypt to discuss climate change. But human rights are overshadowing the beginning of the so-called COP27 summit in the Red Sea resort city of Sharm el-Sheikh. The family of one of Egypt's most prominent political prisoners says that he could die in detention within days, highlighting the Egyptian government's widespread crackdown on its critics. Here's Nick Schifrin.
No one better symbolizes Egypt's lost hope and its regime's repression than Ala Abd El Fattah. He's an activist and software developer who helped drive the 2011 revolution. But in the last decade, he spent more than 9 years in prison. Last December, he was sentenced to 5 years for what the regime called false news, highlighting human rights abuses. And now, after eating only 100 calories a day for 7 months, he is refusing to drink even water.
It feels like he can't control his destiny, that someone has decided that's his destiny, that he will die in prison. So the only thing he can really control is the timeline. And he's, of course, choosing the timing that would be the most embarrassing to the Egyptian authorities.
Sana Saif is Alaa's youngest sister and herself a prominent human rights activist who's been jailed 3 times in the last decade. Overnight, she arrived at the site of COP27 to pressure international leaders to get her brother released.
Are you worried he could die?
I'm really worried he could die. I respect his decision, and I think it's the right decision. I understand where he's coming from, and I agree that this is not a life worth living, neither for him or for us, really, his family outside. But as a sister, I cannot give up hope. I still have hope.
No Egyptian family has fought for justice more tirelessly than the Saifs. Their late father, Ahmed, was the country's leading human rights lawyer. Middle sister, Mona, is currently campaigning for Alaa in London. Their mother, Leila, has protested against 6 governments over 42 years. She was born in London, and last year, Alaa was granted British citizenship. New British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak is attending the climate conference and today met Sisi. A British official says in a statement, Sunak raised Alaa's plight, expressing his serious concerns about this case and calling for Alaa's release. In the past, State Department spokesman Ned Price today didn't go that far.
We've made the point to the Egyptians that improvements when it comes to issues of human rights only serve to strengthen the basis of the bilateral relationship.
Is the British government, is the West doing enough to try and help your brother?
No, I'm worried that they have realized the urgency too late. I can see that they feel the heat, but they're still very timid when it comes to raising human rights concerns.
Human rights organizations accuse Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, of imprisoning more than 60,000 Egyptians across society.
I believe that we should all concentrate on the task at hand.
Today at the conference, Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry suggested to CNBC there would be no diplomacy to release Alaa.
It is dealt with within the penal system, within the rules and regulations.
We're suffocating. There is no breathing room here. The people who are going to create action and to create pressure on our policymakers and our oil companies to operate better towards the climate are the same people who are now languishing in Egyptian prison. In order to get any action towards the planet, you need to have space for people to speak up. You need to have civic space. And that does not exist in Egypt.
World leaders are trying to avoid the death of the planet. But if nothing is done, their work could be overshadowed by the death of one man. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Nick Schifrin.
Ahead of Election Day, many groups face challenges voting, whether early or at the voting booth. For some Native American communities, it is being able to read and understand the voting process and ballots. From the Cronkite School of Journalism in Phoenix, Alexia Stanbridge explains.
It says non-Muslim.
Maxine Wadsworth is a translator for Navajo County Elections, which covers many parts of both the Navajo and Hopi Nation in northern Arizona. Her job is to translate voting information into the Hopi language. Many indigenous languages emphasize oral, not written, communications. So Wadsworth and her team translate election materials, recording audio files that voters can listen to when they vote.
The screen is now on.
These translations allow indigenous voters to fully participate in a process that may determine their future.
It is important for elections to have an interpreter or a translator to help the people understand what their options are in voting and to have the proper tools to assist them in making the right choices.
It's crunch time. The election is just a few days away. The team on the Hopi Nation spends hours translating voting instructions and ballots. In many cases, they have to call election offices for clarification, seeking meanings behind the words.
Makes it very challenging when you're asked to interpret a document which generally has no place in Hopi language at all.
Wadsworth says in the Hopi language, there aren't single terms for certain government roles.
The governor is Itatitzkwai Arizona Sisuvermungwe, who's the leader of the state.
Other election officials, like Rosita Kelly, work for the Navajo Elections Administration. She says it's not as simple as a word-for-word translation.
It would take certain, maybe two or three sentences in Navajo to describe a word.
Tribal nations cover over a quarter of Arizona land, with vast distances between many communities and voting locations. On the Tohono O'odham Nation, the 11 polling places are spread across an area almost the size of Connecticut. There are 22 tribal nations in Arizona. Ballots are translated into just three languages, Hopi, Apache, and Navajo, by the certain counties where the tribes meet guidelines under the Voting Rights Act for English proficiency within their populations. The Tohono O'odham Nation is one of the many tribes whose ballots are not translated. Tribal member Verlin Jose says that puts the older members of his tribe at a disadvantage.
It would impact everyone, mainly the elders, mainly the people that live in communities that are remote who are still very fluent, and it's what they speak every day.
Jose says translations would have additional benefits.
I believe that would help increase the voter turnout because people will more understand what is actually on the ballot.
What does this proposition mean? What does tax mean? What does, you know, different, whatever the propositions are.
Hopi Tribal Registrar Karen Shupla says ballot propositions, whose descriptions and voter guides can be pages long, can be confusing in any language. One resource election workers offer is in-person translations at polling centers, while making sure not to coach tribal members on whom to vote for.
It also helps them to explain, like, don't be afraid, they can translate for you and they'll help you understand the propositions.
The goal, says Maxine Wadsworth of Navajo County Elections, isn't just to make it easier for tribal members to participate in the electoral process. It's to give them voice and power.
It's necessary. It's necessary to inform, give the voters an opportunity for information that could help them making an informed decision for themselves and the things that they believe in.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Alexia Stanbridge with Cronkite News on the Hopi Nation.
So glad we are able to highlight that. And be sure to join us tomorrow for live 2022 election coverage, as well as an interview with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi as we prepare for the results to come in. It all begins on the NewsHour and will be followed with our special coverage throughout the night here on PBS. Plus, you can join us online all afternoon tomorrow with additional analysis at pbs.org/newshour or on our YouTube channel. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. For all of us at the PBS NewsHour, thank you. Please stay safe, and we'll see you soon.